Good evening. Thanks for coming to the pre-council meeting. We have two items on the agenda tonight and just a couple of housekeeping items. So we'll do the housekeeping first, then we'll run through a GIS update, about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, and then we have guests from Ameren who will come update us, come speak with us. Appreciate their presence. And then, so the housekeeping items, this agenda tonight at your next meeting at 7 has a number of potential amendments, and so I just want to bring your attention to three of them. One is an added memo. These are in front of you. Sheila has a packet that she passed out for us. One adding another street closure request, this one for 9th Street Summerfest event. The thicker document under that is an amendment to the classification and pay plan, supplemental information, and then under that, an amendment to the agreement with CAT TV. Both of the amendments are actually minor, but you can tell from CAT it's good stuff, but relatively minor. So as you get time, feel free to read through that. The same is true with the comp and class amendments. These are really reflecting changes that happened over the weekend and with our IBEW partners. So we agree, and we're putting that forward to you for recommended solution. So with that housekeeping announcement, there may be other amendments, of course, when we get to that part of the agenda of changing the agenda. We may have more. I understand Councilmember Thomas and maybe Councilmember Nauzer will have some potentially. So, all right, with that, Dr. Gericke, would you mind taking us through the GIS update?
Not at all. Thank you very much. The city GIS office, as it's been set up, tends to coordinate enterprise projects for the city. These are projects that span multiple departments, multiple divisions, and sometimes prove challenging based on the coordination that we have, but overall try to guide the city both in terms of operations and what we're able to do and also in the information that we can provide to the public in new and different directions. I'd like to touch on two different items. One is a fleet AVL program, which we are starting to implement, and provide a brief overview of that for your information. And the second item is talking about utility information, and we will be seeking council direction on that particular issue. In terms of the fleet AVL piece, I'm sure that many of you have seen this map and have marveled at its positional and timely accuracy, its ease of use, and its ability to discern complicated information really at the touch of a finger. When this idea came about for transit, it got us thinking about the possibilities of having the same type of information and ease of access to more than just Drew Brooks and the transit operators, especially as we're looking across the city fleet. The city has more than 800 vehicles and large pieces of equipment. Some of these are used by particular departments or divisions. Others are held in a pool capacity and are lent down as needed to different departments and divisions. But the city kind of sees this AVL, putting GPS on these different pieces so we can track them, as a useful tool in several areas. One, it helps us keep track of the location and who has each of those 800 pieces of equipment. Two, it becomes a management tool for supervisors, either of the fleet or of operational units, being able to see where your folks are and what work they're doing and how fast they're driving, and who might be able to respond quicker to certain circumstances that might come up in emergency or non-emergency situations. Therefore, increasing operational efficiencies if it's somebody that's working for solid waste or somebody working for the street division or water and light or police or fire. They're all operational efficiencies that can be gained there. And also, it provides a measure of enhancing service. If we are smarter with the folks that we have in the field and how we can deploy them, that provides better customer service in circumstances where it makes sense to communicate that location data to the public, if it is street trucks during snow season, or if it's potentially solid waste trucks as they're running their trash pickup and recycle routes on a weekly basis. That also serves to enhance transparency for our public. Currently, we're negotiating with a vendor that was selected through an RFP process. We have the goals of achieving highly available, flexible, and accessible systems to make that data available and responsive to support decision-making by managers and supervisors, and also for communication. We also have the challenge of making it scalable for operational units. Transit buses are, I think, 40-odd in our fleet. There are about 40 to 50 street vehicles that have an older version of the system. I have no idea how many trucks Water and Light has, or Parks and Rec has, or what parking has, but we have all sorts of different sizes of fleets in different divisions using all sorts of different vehicles, and trying to find something that will make work for everybody. If we tie the data into one system, it makes everybody's job a little bit easier on the further up you go, the management ladder especially. How we're trying to approach this is, in the short term, upgrade existing public works AVL technology in the street division and in the public works environmental division. This system has been in place for about 8 years, and like most things technological, doesn't work as well as things technologically 8 years old do. And we see it as a necessary step to help us with those programs. Midterm, we see it as an option where other divisions in the city can budget for the cost of hardware and then the annual service for the software, and trying to expand that and convert fleets throughout the city. Long-term, the vision is to make this required equipment whenever a vehicle is added or a vehicle is replaced, including that as part of the cost. So that we're not bringing in some pieces of equipment, we're bringing in all the pieces of equipment and expanding all of those efficiencies across the system. The funding for this currently, for the Public Works Department, there's a supplemental in the fiscal 14 budget which will fund that. Using that as a pilot project, we hope to use that conversion process as marketing for other departments and divisions if needed. To include that as budget items for the fiscal 15 year, and see where that takes us in the future.
And what is that cost, approximately?
The hardware one-time cost is less than $400 per vehicle. The monthly service per vehicle is in the realm of $30 to $40 a month, depending on what options are looked at with that. We're leaving that open and flexible at this time to the departments and divisions to apply it or think about it for the fleets that most benefit them and the cost options that make the most sense for their operation. For example, nobody at this time is really interested in vehicle diagnostics, but we want to have that option in the contract in case we choose to go that direction in the future. We don't need 1 to 2 second pings of vehicle location during the summer, during winter snow operations. That's a very desired added expense for the tools it gives us operationally and what we will be able to communicate to the public.
If I could ask a follow-up question. So this will enable staff and the council to get more data information regarding where trucks have gone and been. Like right now, it's hard to follow or get information back on which trash trucks have picked up early trash. So this will help tremendously in the data that the department is using.
Eventually, as the different divisions and departments roll to this system, those types of applications would become available.
Let me ask a related question. With transit, it's a customer service issue. We want customers to know when the bus is going to come to the location. How does it help to know where a trash truck is? I mean, as a customer, I put it out, I want it picked up in the morning. I don't really need to know whether it's 9:30 or 10:30 or 11:30. So from my perspective, I don't see that it helps me as a customer. How does it help the city as a administrator? Because there is an expense to this, a lot of money. And so how does knowing where a trash truck is at a given time, how's that worth the money?
Well, some, I'll take it. Some customers do find it useful. They don't get it out in time, or they, you know, by seeing where the truck is, maybe they could reprioritize their morning and do that. But the other flip side of that coin is it's less important in that service than it is in buses. It just is. And so that's why we're kind of doing this as a pilot outside of transit for Public Works, to see what kind of value there is. Now, from a management perspective, operationally, it could be particularly useful, especially takes plowing snow. You know, where have you been? Hey, you missed three streets because they were snow blind, you know.
So it does keep a map of where you've been.
Yeah, and it's solid place. We have sometimes drivers don't know the routes, and they may miss a whole block. And we've gotten calls from council at 6 in the evening said, you missed our trash service over in here. I can immediately go there and say, yes, we did.
And it'll show the map of where it's been. It'll ping. Okay, that's interesting.
And related use is, for example, in East Campus where there's a lot of trash out early and trucks are coming by and picking up trash, but they're not really keeping track as well as they could keep track of where those places are and where the repeat offenders are and making sure they're billed for trash out early. It's sort of a mess right now, but this should help, it sounds like.
It could. That's what
I
we want to explore.
Yeah.
I'm making a guess that this would also be able to track vehicles to make certain that, especially if they're route vehicles, that they're staying on the routes of which they are supposed to be, making sure that timed breaks are allotted for the times that they're supposed to be,
or not sure how much capable of that out of the box, but I think it can be used for. Yeah.
Well, I suppose if I understand you right, that's the point of doing this as a pilot, is to find all these things out. Am I on track there?
Yes. Yeah, it's really we've purchased this product for transit, and the idea is where else could this be helpful to us throughout the fleet?
Does it make a difference whether or not this is, in terms of expense, whether this is a retrofit or whether you buy vehicles with this kind of capacity on them? There seems to be with this fleet AVL program slide that you have, you're phasing it in according to the need and so on and so forth, and ultimately it would apply to all vehicles with kind of that built-in capacity. Is there any difference there?
I think at this point it's all the same equipment. But so we'd outfit each one with so it's the same cost.
Was one of them an income?
So it's all of the transit buses are technically retrofits, right? Because
that one to each member of council.
Ping you when it's 20 minutes from the meeting time.
I can't keep track of myself.
So constituents can find us.
They haven't for bicycles. We have to get one for bicycles.
Might be fun.
Sounds good.
For whom?
So that's kind of the what we're doing and the direction that we're taking as a city with the fleet AVL program. The other item that we wanted to talk about is bringing back the topic of utility information and seeking council direction on this. We provided an update and have been working on these issues since a pre-council work session in December 2012, at which we were trying to get an understanding and get direction for a process for including new data in City View. And we were directed to continue work on different ways of using or presenting this utility information. At the crux is, do we keep treating utility information and that data as we do now, or do we treat it differently? And if we do treat it differently, what are some of the ways, the forms that this might take? And we feel that very strongly that we need your direction in order to meet the needs and wishes and desires of the city in this regard. Columbia is rather unique in that because we have a municipal electric utility and a municipal water utility combined, that the utility records that we have are a matter of public record. The costs, the usage, the highs, the lows, anybody can walk over to the utility billing office and request that data. And we provide that to folks that live there, folks that are looking at renting a place, folks that are looking at buying a place, because we kind of see that as a public record. Several different groups that are part of the city or partnering with the city have requested that this utility information be provided to a wider audience or be provided in a different way. The Green Rental Housing Tool Collaborative Project, funded by the Urban Sustainability Directors Network through Indiana University and with the town of Bloomington, Indiana, has requested it. Barbara Buffalo in our sustainability position is involved with that group. The Rental Housing Energy Efficiency Group, which has the City of Columbia through Office of Neighborhood Services and the Department of Health, along with the Columbia Housing Authority, Central Missouri Community Action, has asked for it as well. They're trying to build a website based on a tools for tenants model, trying to make energy efficiency information more available to renters. In both of these two examples, what Indiana University is doing and what Tools for Tenants is doing, they don't have data directly provided. They're crowdsourcing it. They're asking folks to send in what their utility bills are and providing a way of storing it. But both of these groups, as they are part of the city, city commissions, notably the Energy and Environment Commission, or Environment and Energy Commission, if I flip them, I know it's one of the two. And several neighborhood associations have asked that, well, what are we doing with this data? Can we make this data more available, especially for this purposes of communicating to the public? And so we've worked with this, and this data is somewhat complicated to work with, and so we approach it from the goal of effective communication. What are some ways that this might look? And so we'll briefly go over what an application base might look like, what a map base might look like, and what a feed base might look like. In terms of an application, this is a test that city staff have developed where you put in an address and search for it. It'll return the type of information that we see in City View, but also give you the opportunity to select addresses. And when you hit the select address button, you'll see a list of all of the different utility accounts based on a point reference of where they are on your surface listed. And if you click on one of those, you can see a listing of what each of those utility bills was for the past, I think in this case, 24 months. In this example, just giving the cost of the electric service, the average, the high and the low, in a graph. That's something that might be well fit for a mobile website or wrapping up in forms of an app for a mobile device. On the map-based side, we feel that there are two ways that this could be communicated. Both have its challenges. One would be to take a similar approach to the application base and just show all the points. In this demo, all of the points here on this map are rental properties. We kind of segmented out the utility bills for demonstration purposes. And if you zoom in on different areas, or especially a large apartment complex, you get a sense of how many different utility bills are there. And sometimes that varies depending on how the landlord wishes to set up the utility meters. And if you click on one of those, you can find the electric cost statistics for this particular unit, apartment 1009, a minimum, a maximum, an average cost, as well as the usage statistics in kilowatt hours, a minimum of 31.9, a maximum of 1,317.3 for an average over 36 months of 389. One of the issues with this approach is that not of our electric customers, our water customers, and you'll see on the bottom part there that there isn't any information for the water statistics. If I bounce down to a rental property on Broadway, we can see that they're both, the electric costs that we could do or the water costs that we could do. This approach handles those number of accounts very well and just kind of presents that data for what it is, for where it is. It doesn't tie a lot of other information to it. Another map approach would be taking that data and aggregating it to parcels, or we could do other units, especially where there's a concern of individual behavior may vary. If you have 600 apartment units and they turn over each year, you might be talking about 1,800 different individual human behaviors, and for an apartment complex. Do we gain better communication by trying to average those and say, well, most of these units are going to be relatively comparable, they're part of the same complex, they're built at the same time. If we average those, that gives us some measure of figure towards that. And we could also include data like the rental status, if it's a rental or not, or if it's a home performance with Energy Star customer. In City View, the approach that this would take would just be adding on more items to that information panel. On this particular example, we just have some of the electric cost data on the bottom. But if we pursue this, that list could get a whole lot longer. And that's one of the challenges of this approach also is to what extent do we keep running down the list of the data that would be available. But essentially all of that data that we showed for the points, the electric cost, the electric usage, the water cost, the water usage, we can aggregate by parcel or even block or neighborhood, depending on preference. The other item would be a feed base, and this is kind of a difficult concept to explain, but if you think about the utility bill that you get every month, and when you get that line that has your address, your account number, the kilowatt hours used, and the cost, that line would go into a table. And everybody's utility bill, whenever it's run, that line would go into a table. And each time it gets run, all those records would keep getting longer and longer and longer for each billing cycle. The data feed approach would make that table available to the public or available to other developers so that they could take that location information of where that house is or where that business is and the kilowatt hours and the cost and do something else with that and develop their own maps, develop their own applications. That feed could include that address information, latitude and longitude, the electric cost and or usage, the water cost and or usage. And that's something that really for some of our city partners with the Indiana University or the rental efficiency group, something that would really drive forward what they're trying to do with their different projects. In talking about something like this, there remain issues on the base level. If we change from what we're currently doing, we would be making public data more accessible in a very different form than we're making it accessible now. We're taking it from calling the utility billing office or coming into City Hall to anybody could pull it up on a website or a web map or through a data stream. And that's a very big departure from our current process. Some of the other issues is that our system of billing utilities can be rather complicated. It's pretty easy for single-family residential. When we start talking about duplexes or large apartment complexes and the different ways that master meters can be structured for electric or for water, that adds complexity to pulling that data out. And for others using that data, how to interpret it or how to make the most use of it. In working with this data, we found inaccurate meter readings, things that didn't look right that we call utility billing, and they contact the utilities and, oh, we need to go repair that meter. And so, there are issues with that. The data doesn't tell the whole picture. We don't have a good data source if a house has electric heat or gas heat. That's going to make a big difference for electric cost and electric usage. as well as the variating condition of housing stock across the city and human behavior. The other contextual information is that, in looking at this from this issue, we cannot find an example of another municipal electric utility that makes this type of data this open in this way. In some ways, that presents something of an opportunity for the city. That might also present something of a risk for the city if we're the first to take on something like this. Especially peer cities that we've looked at, Austin, Texas, and their energy data library, I was kind of excited. What might I find in their data library? The most data that was there is for 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, 2012, their total number of residential customers, their total number of commercial customers, and then the total kilowatt hours used by both in a separate table. And that's a very different type of data than we are being asked to provide for our utility information. So we're kind of looking for direction on this policy direction. We could stay with the status quo of what we're doing now and make that information available on individual requests through utility billing, or we can make that open and available through these different websites and web maps and data feeds. If we look to go that route, we have some other choices to make. Do we want to make each and every utility account available and out there? Do we want to classify that in some way and only share a segment of those? Would we want to share the usage or cost or both? Do we want to give out that raw data as raw as possible? Do we want to try to show that point-based? Should we try to aggregate that on the city side? Does the city want to try to map this, or do we just put out a data feed? And the other big issue is associated information. If we just put out raw data, an address is associated with it, but nobody's name. Some of the other ways of doing it, tends to become a privacy concern for some folks if their names are directly related with things. And so these are issues that we brought to the council before and we've worked with as staff, but really seeking your direction about which way to go with this.
If I wanted to go down to the city utility department, I wanted to rent whatever house, can I pull up all the prior billings?
I'm sorry, say
I can again. Pull up all the prior billings if I wanted to go know the history of a property that I wanted to rent?
Yes.
You can. And so?
The requests tend to be in smaller units, a house here or an apartment here.
Right.
But it falls under the guidelines of a records request.
And so nobody is being denied this information, but just to throw this out there on the web for anybody to start doing searches, I mean, I just kind of have a problem, speaking of privacy issues, to just throwing this all out on the web that anybody can walk in and just start doing web searches of businesses and people's homes. And, I mean, personally, I think my personal water consumption and my electric utility usage is my business unless I want to sell my property, and then I disclose that to the buyer. I just don't want everybody going around saying, well, they use this amount of electricity and they use this amount of water, because, again, you have no idea what I'm doing, and I really have a problem. You know, we're hearing more and more about this with smart metering and smart utilities that law enforcement and all these other agencies are having access to all this information about our personal habits, and I mean that's really very concerning to me as far as the privacy issue. And it's not being denied to anybody if they make a personal request, because it is a records request. But there's something completely different about throwing this out on the web.
I guess I don't have quite that problem with this. My background in research suggests that this could be really useful information in terms of aggregating some of the data that's already available in terms of these accounts. For some of the folks who are really interested in this. It is the Environment and Energy Commission. I was there for a while, but it's easy to mix those names up. But I do know that Barbara Buffalo, who was the staff liaison to that group, was always very interested in the questions, came up on many occasions. The difficulty of getting information from someone like Ameren, for example, no offense to the Ameren folks here, but with respect to what we offer, and a lot, I guess the the question here becomes the extent to which this, how much does this cost, not only in terms of dollars, but in terms of staff time, to provide the kinds of service to aggregate some of this data in a useful fashion that can be available to folks. And how much do we just leave in raw data that people can access and aggregate themselves? I mean,
I guess there's another question, which is how much staff time is spent answering the ad hoc requests for the people who walk in? Is there a dollar figure on that? Because you can get that now if you want to buy a house. You go look at, or if you want to rent a house, you can go request the utility information. Do we have any idea how much staff time is spent on that?
I do not know the answer to that.
The third question is whether by putting everything online, one big staff push to do that, and then a system for continually updating it automatically would make staff time savings overall, because those public record requests would go straight to the web page and wouldn't involve staff at all.
Yeah, that was sort of my conjecture, was do we know whether this is a savings or a cost to staff?
You know, I just to that point, I really think of it as you have a staff, and so what do you want us to work on? You know, is kind of the question to ask here. It's not, I don't think it's a particularly appreciable sum of money that we could equate time to a certain cost and do we save. We could certainly do that analysis, but my guess is it's not much.
Okay, because that would be the thing is if we are providing the information anyway, if it's legally a public record, there could be an argument for, you know, I agree with Ms. Nauzer that there are privacy concerns here. Unfortunately, it is public, and there are constituencies that it would benefit, which would be tenant groups, tenant advocacy groups, and that type of group that would, you know, want to, the groups that are assisting people with utilities and can advocate for and get people in appropriate apartments. Would make a lot of sense, and I don't know if we could provide the data in like a RANA form that they could use without making it too easy for, you know, just somebody to nose around and, you know, find out whether I'm home by what my utility usage is.
Another question. The records request, is that only because we're a public utility?
Yes.
Being run by the city, so if it's a private...
It is my understanding.
It's a city-owned operation, therefore it's a records request, so.
And it's not real-time, right? It would be last month's.
We are looking at doing a 36, taking the last 36 months and averaging that out, using that for the figures, trying to exclude months where we know that there is no data, especially for new construction. That becomes an issue. And we would probably try to settle on a frequency of probably every 6 months or once a year that we would update that. And once we have the direction to do something, it'll take some effort and some work automating that and getting it into its final form. But after then, it really wouldn't be as much cost and staff time as running a process every 6 months or a year and updating the data.
Let me ask a question about, there's a number of very large apartment complexes in town. Are most of those, the newer ones, are they gas? Are they electric? I mean, how are they being constructed? I don't have any idea. And the reason I say that is that you sort of eliminate privacy concerns if you report in aggregate. In other words, if there's a 50-complex apartment that is poorly insulated, well, it has a per-unit cost per year, which could then be directly compared with another unit that is much more efficient. And that would allow the private sector to do the marketing for us.
That's right.
In other words, if you would look on your apartment complex and say, well, I'm 20% below McDavid's apartments, so I'm going to tell my clients low utility rates.
Right.
And So that would preclude any privacy issues since we're talking about aggregates and cohorts.
On the other thing, we were talking about average high and lows. I mean, the data is available on individuals, but generally speaking, these aggregations are talking about these kinds of averages. But this is an opportunity for marketing. Those are the kinds of questions that came up. So it can not only benefit the tenant associations and maybe the tenants, but also some of the landlords.
It might incentivize landlords to improve their energy efficiency if they know they're being compared adversely with their competition.
The difficulty really comes in the individual behavior thing, because when you get these numbers in aggregate, people who abuse their thermostat, let's put it that way, open the windows and turn the thermostat up in the middle of winter, or build a fire because it's nice to have that aesthetic thing, and then turn the air conditioner on. That kind of thing is the kind of problem that you run up against when you get these averages in here.
I think another aspect of this is what information is helpful to staff, water and light, and other departments in terms of programs that they're trying to increase,
yeah,
and incentivize. And so there may be information that would be helpful for the city and staff to know, and then that could be shared, or some of that could be shared online, and it can be another way for consumers to be better, wiser consumers and get more information or knowledge without going over the line to privacy concerns. So those are the things I'm sort of thinking about.
I'd like for staff to think about, brainstorm what kind of cohorts you can come up with that are meaningful in terms of comparison, in terms of size, age, or whatever you want to do it, so that consumers can look at a unit and know that the average utility rates are lower in this complex than the one across the street, which was shabbily put together.
What I would suggest to staff is that they maybe contact some tenant advocacy and agencies and utility assistance agencies, and maybe ask them how they would use this data, what data would be useful in helping them, because I would think if we're going to go down the road of putting this all out on the web, it might be useful to target those customers, because those would be sort of our heavy users, I would think. That would be my sense. My sense would be that you move ahead with something and maybe ask these questions and do it like as a pilot, if you can do it on the cheap and just kind of see how it works, and then revise and see what sort of feedback there is.
And I would like Water and Light Board and Environment and Energy Commission to weigh in on it.
And maybe CDBG or some board that would be interested in tenant issues.
But we're not going to be comparing apples to apples, because we're going to be comparing apartments or rental homes that were built in 2012 and some that were built in 1995. And the energy standards and the construction standards are completely different.
Right.
So
make
what is
a good
it?
Decision on
but how many consumers really actually go and look at the utilities? I'm going to venture to say not very many.
Well, I would think
it's
the
a lot
owner
of
would market it.
In order to find this data out, it takes a lot of work. I mean, the Environment and Energy Commission wanted some of this data to take a look at some of this stuff, and essentially we were told it's very difficult to get a lot of this comparison data. I think maybe the extent to which we do, maybe we could have some sort of tiered approach as well, and have kind of this aggregate light available to we do ourselves a lot of favors on the City Council when we are very transparent in terms of information that is public information. And I certainly think that we ought to make some of this available, some of the more detailed and important aggregate information available to folks. The extent to which we make all of it available, it becomes almost unworkable, unless you happen to be a researcher that are looking at in a particular thing. So I'm just kind of thinking out loud along this tiered approach in some way.
The type of raw data and what folks can do with it is particularly what's been requested by the Rental Housing Efficiency Group, who is building a website to, with partnership to try to do this for the city, as well as the green housing folks. You know, that they have a website, they have the map, they're trying to contribute data for that.
Sounds like you've already talked to the groups I was interested in you talking to.
I like the idea of sharing it. There is,
you know, it's a slight degradation in privacy.
It's a big degradation of privacy.
Well, I mean, the information's already there. If you're running a marijuana grow operation, the police can go and check your utility usage and get a warrant right now. There's nothing protecting anyone from secretly growing large amounts of marijuana with electrical-based fluorescent lights. That's what utility use, why do I want it private? If you're not doing that. So, I mean, that information's already available. And if motivated people would go get it. So it's what we're talking about is easing it out onto the web, and people do use casual information more, and they'll develop apps and look at stuff and look at aggregate data, and they might publish how much electricity all of us use if they can figure out where we live.
That's not the point.
But I think that, you know, they could do that now if they were motivated to do that, and they should, because I just went solar, so I probably zeroed out this month. So go ahead and look. But I'm just saying the real nitty-gritty stuff people can already do, and motivated people will do that. And the casual users might market. You know, maybe they're going to send out energy efficiency stuff to high users of electricity and things like that, and that's kind of good. So I think in general information, you know, I don't see a malicious nature to that information being more easily accessible because it's already private. I wouldn't switch it from private to public, but we're talking about ease of access.
Public.
Ease of access for public information. It seems more good than bad to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there seems to be some public good that can come from this.
Well, and just to maybe bring the conversation to a close, if I might, I think we're certainly focused on keeping names of individuals out of it. It's simply focused on the address as well. So that might be a little bit of comfort level.
But address equates to people, just like my driver, my license plate.
If you know,
to my name on my registration.
Your neighbors will
so
have
does
more
my,
information.
My address.
Well,
constantly stretching this boundary.
This has been helpful, and we'll try to follow up on that and come back with more. Thank you very much. In the interest of time, I'd like to introduce Warren Mueller from Ameren UE.
He can come into that.
Warren, maybe 10 or 15 minutes for Q&A will be.
We will make it brief.
All right.
We appreciate the opportunity to come before you tonight to share with you our environmental cleanup plans for what I refer to now as the old works headquarters of the gas operations here in town, because our staff has, I understand, just moved to the new location this past weekend. My name is Warren Miller, and I am the manager of environmental assessments in the environmental department, and I have personally either managed or overseen a number of cleanups here in Missouri, Jefferson City, Excelsior Springs, Boonville, and Moberly. And these were done both under the state and federal programs, and this cleanup that we're proposing to do tonight is going to be done under the state voluntary cleanup program. And I also have here with me tonight, I have Mike Holman, whom you probably all know is the manager of Missouri Gas Operations, and Brian Daniels, who's our corporate communications specialist, and Holly Whipfler, who is our community relations specialist. So we've got lots of people to answer questions if anybody has any questions. And last but not least, the guy who gets to do all the talking is our consultant, Dave Kluhar, with Phillips Services. And Dave used to work for Union Electric. In fact, he was a project manager for the cleanup of the former gas plant site on the other side of Orr Street. We're cleaning up the east side, and he cleaned up the west side, and now he's going to manage cleaning up the east side for us. So I'm going to turn this over to Dave.
Thank you very much. For the sake of the time we have left, I do have a PowerPoint handout there.
Thank you.
In the notes page format, we'll forego the formal PowerPoint, and I probably am going to skip some of the 17 slides here as well for the sake of time. For those of you just to that are not exactly familiar with the location of the property, the address is 210 North Orr Street. This is, again, the former Ameren Service Center property at the corner of Orr and Park Street in the, I think you call it the North Central Columbia area. On the next slide, the property is about 2.1 acres. It is entirely fenced. There are presently four structures on the property, the Ameren office building, a storage building, and two car parking sheds. The property is entirely paved or covered with buildings. Reason why we're here talking to you this evening about the property is historically, the Ameren property on the east side of Orr Street was the gas storage portion of the manufactured gas plant that had operated on the west side of Orr Street, as Warren mentioned, that was cleaned up in 1994. The east side of the property of the gas plant has remained with the utility company since the days when the gas plant was in operation and has just now become their former reporting center. Excuse me. So there are gas storage operations, historic gas storage operations on the property that have left a historic environmental problem. The next slide just shows an old photograph of the neighborhood in 1915. You can see the gas holder in the background in the center of the photograph from 1915. That gas holder is sitting under where the Ameren office building is now, and that's the center of our environmental problems at this point. The reason why we are going to be completing the remedial action is because many of the contaminants do have health effects associated with exposure to the chemicals in the contaminants. Based on the toxicological studies, the health effects can range from minor to cancer, frankly. However, at the Ameren property, the contaminants are all underground. As I mentioned, the property is paved or under buildings, so the potential exposure pathways would be either ingestion of contaminated soil or contaminated groundwater, direct skin contact, or inhalation. At this point, on this property, all of those pathways are incomplete. So there is not presently an exposure to the contaminants to either the Ameren folks on site or to the surrounding community. To complete the remediation, we will be doing so under the oversight of the Missouri Department of Natural Resources within their risk-based voluntary cleanup program, which is part of the Brownfields Department at the Missouri DNR. The risk-based program provides essentially a step-by-step process to evaluate the property and establish acceptable remediation objectives based on the potential current exposure and planned future use of the property and those potential exposures as well. We have been talking with the DNR about this property since about March of this year and have described in general terms what the remedial action plan is to the DNR at this point. And they, without formally approving or commenting on the project, they are on board with the approach we are planning to use. Essentially, the remedial action will be a fairly straightforward project. It's excavation using standard excavation techniques. The excavated materials will be loaded into over-the-road haul trucks. Haul trucks are tarped to cover the loads, and then the material is transported to licensed, approved landfills around the state. The landfill or landfills have not yet been selected at this point. When we believe we've reached acceptable cleanup levels on the site, the technicians on the property will collect soil samples at the limits of the excavation. The samples are sent to analytical laboratory for analysis and confirmation that, yes, indeed, we have removed contamination to the level that we have reached the remediation goal for the soil at the site. At that point, clean backfill is brought to the site, and the excavation areas are backfilled. To complete the excavation, we expect to do a limited amount of what we call open-air excavation, which is what you probably would normally see on most construction activities. It's not undercover. However, Ameren on their MGP sites has made it a practice to do the majority of their remedial action excavations undercover. To do this, we use what we call a temporary structure, which is essentially a large tent. Understand from David Nichols that the City of Columbia has some temporary structures that they use for storage. We will do 95% of the excavation will be undercover at this project. The site controls that we will implement for the remedial action to maintain the health and safety of the workers on the site, as well as for the surrounding community, will include decontamination procedures for the equipment entering the work zone or maintaining that equipment and the vehicles that are hauling the soil from the site on clean surfaces. We will monitor for odors and dust during the project when we're doing open air excavations. The temporary structure will control those matters when we're under the temporary structure. If we're doing open air excavations and the monitoring indicates we are releasing either odors or dust, the cleanup contractor will have either water sprays or vapor suppressing products that they can put on the excavation to control the odors and the dust. We will implement a stormwater pollution prevention plan to control contaminated runoff from the excavation during the project. And we also have what we hope to get approval on, a traffic safety plan for vehicular and pedestrian traffic around the site while we're doing the work. One of the things that we feel is always important with these projects is getting community acceptance of the proposed truck route for the contaminated soil being hauled from the site. Given the location here, frankly, in downtown Columbia, we felt that there were a limited number of routes that would be reasonably acceptable for the soil being hauled from the site. We are proposing that the primary gate for the project would be on Park Street, just north of the intersection with Orr, and that loads from that gate would proceed west on Park to 10th Street, and north on 10th to Rogers, east on Rogers to College, and north on College to the Business Loop 70, and then out to the Interstate 70. Again, we have not identified the landfill, but we felt that that was the most direct route out to the highway, regardless of where the landfills may be. Clean soil being hauled in to backfill the excavation would use that same route. As part of the project, as I mentioned, we will have a traffic control plan that we will be submitting to Public Works for review and approval, because there are some aspects to the remedial action plan that will require city approval because of the nature of how we're planning to execute the work. On the slide that's titled Traffic Control Plan, you can see some of the details. The west property line for the Ameren property now runs on a diagonal across the front of the office building. We propose to revise the property fence location all the way out to sidewalk along Orr Street and then along North Park. And you'll see in a minute why we need that fence line moved. So we're requesting permission to relocate the construction fence for the remedial action out into the street right-of-way adjacent to the sidewalk. In doing so, then, we're also going to be requesting that the sidewalk on the east side of Orr and on the east side of Park Street between Ash and St. James is closed to pedestrians during the project. The sidewalk would be barricaded at those two intersections and posted with signs indicating that pedestrians should cross to the opposite side of the street at this point. This is really mostly a safety issue because of the trucks coming in and out of the site. We just felt that this is a busy area for pedestrians, and keeping them on the opposite side of the street was important for their safety. Signs will be posted on Park and Orr Street approaching the site, identifying the fact that trucks are entering the roadway. And then we, depending on the trucking company and their needs for getting trucks in and out of the site, we may be requesting some parking restrictions opposite the gates the trucks will be using during the project. A little more detail on the temporary structure and why we use it. As I mentioned, it covers the majority of the excavation. The structure is a metal frame, fabric-clad building, essentially, with doors added to get the trucks and work equipment in and out. But then the structure is ventilated through activated carbon filters, and these are 20,000-pound activated carbon filters. We will have approximately six or seven of these. They ventilate the structure, maintain a slight negative pressure on the structure so that we're not releasing dust and contaminants or vapors from the excavation. That airstream is being captured and filtered through the activated carbon before it's released to the atmosphere, and then a technician monitors the outlet on the activated carbon. So it allows us to do the excavation regardless of the weather and maintain air quality at the site at the same time. There is a slide there that shows a temporary structure of approximately the same dimensions that we'll be using here in Columbia. The site and the excavation area that we are planning will accommodate a structure that's 40 meters wide and 75 meters long. That's approximately 130 by 250 feet. The structures are modular. They're actually made in Germany, so everything's metric, but they come in 5-meter sections, so we're putting up as much as we can fit on the property, frankly. And as you can see from the aerial photograph that shows where we intend to put the structure, it is out in the right-of-way, which is another reason why we'll be requesting permission for encroachment into the right-of-way for the project. The gate for most of the traffic, again, is on North Park. Most of the truck traffic will go in and out through that north end of the temporary structure during the project, with perhaps backfill coming in off of Orr or Ash at the south end of the site. The other thing that we will do, as we do at all of the other MGP projects for Ameren, as a public safety matter, is air monitoring during the project. We conduct on a daily basis two kinds of air monitoring. The first type is called real-time air monitoring. This is essentially done by having a technician walk the project perimeter during the workday with real-time instrumentation that monitors air quality on an instantaneous basis. So he'll know immediately whether we have a dust emissions problem or an emission of volatile organic compounds that need to be addressed, so that he can alert the construction manager to take steps to eliminate the emissions. The second type of air monitoring that we do is called time-integrated sampling. This is essentially high-volume sampling at fixed stations on the project perimeter. We use EPA methods to do that sampling. The samplers run for 72-hour periods. And it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. At the end of the 72-hour period, the technicians shut the samplers down. They collect the media, put in fresh media, and turn the samplers back on. And that sampling is done, frankly, to document the air quality from the beginning of the project to the end against the air quality prior to the project. Essentially, this is how we document that we have not affected air quality in the neighborhood during the project. The last slide that I've got here describes briefly the community information plan that Ameren uses during their cleanup projects. They have a very well-established program that you'll no doubt become very, very familiar with that includes information releases to local government, to state representatives, the local community, and to local media outlets. They provide periodic updates during the project, and we generally have a what we call an open house at some point during the project. Once the temporary structure is up, before the work actually begins, they invite the local city officials and the neighborhood to come in, see what the structure is all about, how we're going to be ventilating the structure, the type of equipment we use, and ask questions to both Ameren and to the DNR in this case. So.
Appreciate your walking through that so quickly. Wish we had a little more time, honestly, but it is time for the regular council meeting. Is there any questions you'd like to ask before we?
Two brief things. One is what, from beginning to end, how long are we talking about here in terms of the duration of this?
Somewhere between 6 and 12 months.
Okay. It's
not specific yet.
And with regard to the hauling of these materials and so on, is there any provision for dealing, Ms. Hoppe occasionally brings this issue up in terms of some of the damage that might be done to some of the streets with this kind of heavy
traffic?
Yes,
thank you. We will be documenting condition of the route near the site before the project begins, photo documentation. We then typically have our site construction manager check conditions periodically during the project, and historically Ameren has addressed pavement damage at the end of the projects.
Real quick, what was your route again? Did you say to haul that stuff out? You're going to go up Park Street to 10th?
Park to 10th, north on 10th to Rogers, east on Rogers to College, and north on College to the highway.
And you didn't look at just going straight up Park to Rogers? Because my concern is going in front of Columbia College and close to the junior high school during morning and afternoon drops off.
That was also my concern. But Park Street from the Ameren property up to Rogers is barely wide enough for a Volkswagen.
Right.
Yeah, we didn't think we could get trucks up that route.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's take a 2-minute break and start very quickly.
Yeah.